Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
I just found this. Do you know this record?
Ben Sidra. I remember Ben Sidra.
I Lead a Life.
Yes.
He's gone. Did you see him?
I think I saw him. But am I imagining this? At the Farnham Maltings?
I have really no idea.
I don't know.
At the Farnham Maltings. It's possible. He's very kind of jazzy, you know, jazz funk. Briefly a member, I think, of the Steve Miller Band.
Yes, he was.
In their early days. And I really like this record. I've got a few Ben Sidra records. And the reason I got it out was it's a reminder of the day. It's 1972, I think it was, when you could decide that your album cover was going to be your bare foot.
Your bare foot
sticking
out the back
of
a car
window. You know,
implying what, though? Implying
really
what? That you're up to some kind of hanky-panky on the back seat?
Possibly. Or just, I don't give a hoot. I would have thought that's more like...
Yeah, it's my foot.
But I tell you, it's my foot. I'll do what I like with it. Yeah. I tell you what it reminded me of, and I don't know if you've got an equivalent. I think this is on the Blue Thumb label. And I've decided, actually, Blue Thumb were my favourite label. You know what I mean? Not in the sense that they produce loads of hits or anything like that. But, you know, there are always just certain labels, I find, that you really warm to. And I've always found...
Who else was on it?
Well, things like Dave Mason was on Blue Thumb.
Oh, yeah, Traffic.
Crusaders were on Blue Thumb. I think Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks in the early days were on Blue Thumb. I think they were.
Well, I ought to know that because I've got nearly all their albums.
Okay.
I'm going with you.
And there was a very cool label that never had a golden touch at all. But I just really like the idea of a label called Blue Thumb. And whenever I see a Blue Thumb record, I tend to get it. And so, you know, Ben Sidra may never have hit the heights, but, you know, at least we're talking about him, right?
We're talking about him now. They may not have had the commercial nous if the kind of people that they signed were Ben Sidra and Dan Hicks.
Oh, absolutely.
Never destined for anything, their name written in lights, really.
But
we love them.
We remember them fondly.
We do.
Okay, the Stack Waddy game, who's going first?
Shall I go first?
Go on.
All right, Dave, let me paint a picture. You're at the Great Western Rock Festival. Great Western Express, it was called, actually. It was in Lincoln in 1972. I was there, actually. You've probably just seen the Beach Boys. You may have seen Wishbone Ash. You've seen Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Right.
Obviously, you've seen Rory Gallagher. You've been cavorting the foam machine. And you're tempted by the tent, the marquee, that's calling itself the Giants of Tomorrow. So it's putting on rock
acts.
They had a Giants of Tomorrow tent. And that's where the bands were playing that they imagined would be headlining in 2 years this time. Or they would conquer the world. Now, six of these groups, I'm saying, played at the Giants of Tomorrow tent in 1972, although one of them is fictitious.
Okay.
Five of them are real. Okay. Can you spot the rogue entry? Okay. There's Byzantium.
Yeah.
Tea and Sympathy.
Yeah.
Narwhal.
Yeah.
Jade Warrior.
Yeah.
Spread Eagle.
Yeah.
And Magic Carpet. Shall I recap?
I'm going to get wrong. We're real. Byzantium were real. Carry on.
They were. Tea and Sympathy.
Were real.
Very good. Narwhal.
Not so sure. Carry on.
Okay. Jade Warrior.
Were real.
Okay. Spread Eagle.
Not so sure.
And Magic Carpet.
Right. Okay. God, I'm going to say your ringer is Magic Carpet.
Okay. No, actually, they're real. No, the ring was Narwhal, which I thought actually wasn't going to be very convincing. But I was trying to think of a name for them. There was a period around then of those kind of slightly heavy, you know, loons and patchouli oil, kind of slightly metallic. Well, not metallic, but heavy bands.
Yeah.
Post Black Sabbath. I thought Narwhal might work. Yeah. Very good.
Well, you win.
Rare occasion, I win. Go on, what have you got for me?
Okay, we're going to travel to the great nation of Canada. You know, the Canadians have certain very distinctive national characteristics. They're kind of straightforward, the Canadians. The Canadians are modest. You know, the Canadians don't put on airs, okay? Which is why when they invent rock and roll bands, they tend to invent them with the dullest, most kind of modest titles that they can possibly come up with. And so
unpretentious, isn't it?
Yeah. Here are five Canadian rock bands, okay?
Are they from any particular era? No,
they go different eras, and they all begin with T, okay? Yeah. All right? And so you've got to spot which one was not real.
This is very good.
Canadian rock bands, okay. Triumph.
Yeah.
Trooper.
Yeah.
Truth.
Truth, was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
3 Days Grace. The Tea Party. Triumph, Trooper, Truth, 3 Days Grace, The Tea Party.
Wow, that's a testing one. The Tea Party, I think, sounds too frivolous, actually. And also, there were various groups called The Tea Party, so I'm suggesting it probably wasn't them. Truth, that's possible. Truth and Trooper are possible, because they've got that kind of workmanlike, solid, dependable, unpretentious, no frills thing. Triumph, I think, is too celebratory and not right. 3 Days Grace is a brilliant name for a band. So brilliant, I think it's probably real. And I'm going to go for either Trooper or Truth. And I'm saying it's Trooper. Trooper are the ringers.
I win. Because Trooper were real. Trooper were real. Triumph are real. Trooper were real. 3 Days Grace are real. Tea Party real. Truth. Not real.
Okay.
I just made that
That's
up.
A brilliant observation, though.
What?
Canadian bands. They are very... There is something very kind of... It's ordinary, isn't it?
No, but it's not.
Were there any glam metal bands in Canada? I doubt it.
Oh, I'm sure there would have been, but there would have been very apologetic glam metal bands, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's just something about the Canadian personality and character. Doesn't like putting itself forward. Doesn't put on airs at all.
That's true.
Know? Whereas kind of pop music requires people to put on airs. But, you know, that's... So that's a stank waddy game for this week. What were you saying to me was happening in the natural history?
Oh, there's a story. I think you saw that news story about a guy called Dermot Kennedy. He's an Irish singer-songwriter. And I thought this was really brilliant because I got so much sympathy for all these artists desperately trying to think of interesting ways to carry on the live circuit. And what he'd done is he'd hired the now deserted Natural History Museum with a theatrical producer and an actor and all sorts of dramatic elements involved and put out a live stream performance. I mean, I think that sounds really, really ingenious and exciting. Wouldn't you want to see somebody, I mean, I'm imagining, delivering their songs from beside a giant fossilised lizard or a huge display of Patagonian butterflies. I mean, that's good, isn't it? Do you think?
I think the
trouble with live performance on virtual live performance is it seems thrilling initially. You know, you feel that sense of proximity and you feel you've keyed into somebody in their home or whatever, and it seems that you're making some kind of connection, and then very soon the visual element of it kind of just dies away because nothing ever changes, and it starts to feel really artificial and claustrophobic and remote. And the idea of somebody, you know, doing something in the Natural History Museum, I think it's really good. Obviously, he's charging for it. You know, it's put out all time zoned all around the world, and all sorts of commemorative merchandise is offered in various bundles and signed vinyl 7 inches, and you've got a Zoom call meet and greet. I thought that was pretty ingenious. It's good, isn't it?
I'm very taken by various different elements of this. I love the idea of museums and galleries.
Completely, you could do it in art.
Nobody in them.
Yeah, you could do it in
Alan Bennett. Alan Bennett has been repeatedly offered knighthoods and various honours and has turned them down. But the only thing he accepted was he was, I don't know if he still is, but he was a trustee of the National Gallery in London. And he said he did it because he could do some good, but also the perk was that you got to go in the National Gallery before it opened in the morning. And you think to yourself, my God, that would be exciting, wouldn't it?
That be fun?
You pop in the National Gallery at 8
you
o'clock in the morning.
Straight to see your favourite picture. And there's nobody else there at all. That's fantastic.
And then tomorrow I'm going to go and see, you know, whatever, different painting. I thought, oh God, I can't imagine a perk greater than that. You know?
That is amazing. And, can I just say, this is going to sound, I'm going to cut in here because it's going to sound awful, actually, but I was invited to, when Tony Blair was elected Prime Minister, he had various parties, and I was invited to, me and my wife, to one of those parties. And it's absolutely incredible. In 10 Downing Street, there's a little room off the top, near the kind of cabinet room where they all meet, where there are just paintings. And in that room, and I know because I was shown it, are a Turner and a Constable. So one of them is of Hampstead Heath. And just the idea that, you know, you've had a long day in the office, you come back, you know what I mean? You take the top off a can of lager and you go into your little room and there is an original Constable, an original Turner. Don't you think that would be absolutely...
I think so. A couple of years ago, I read the Guardian art critic. They had a piece about just pick the best painting in London, what you'd think is the best painting.
Yeah.
Or did he say in Britain? I can't remember. Anyway, but he said the best painting in London is the Rembrandt self-portrait at Kenwood House in Hampstead, you know, which is on the edge of Hampstead Heath. And it's a kind of museum and, you know, place of resort.
I've seen it. Yeah.
And I just went, I thought, that's a really good thing. And I went up there quite early one morning, and it's never overrun, certainly during school terms and so forth, not that many people. And I just went in there, went into the room where the Rembrandt self-portrait was, and I was on my own.
Oh, on your own?
On my own for half an hour.
Not even a security person?
No. There's somebody. No, they don't... Yeah, I'm sure there's somebody looking at you somewhere behind the arras. But, excuse me, I thought that was absolutely such a special thing to be on your own with something like that. And of course, when those paintings were, you know, any of those paintings were initially done, that's how they would be seen, wouldn't it? You know, there might be an unveiling, but then they would go to the kind of rich patron, wouldn't they? Or whoever bought them. And they would stay in their drawing room for years. You know, that's where they would be looked at. They wouldn't be looked at by loads of people being herded past, thinking, as Alan Bennett always remarks about art, it's very good, but it's very hard on the feet. And it's true. It's great truth about art. Most people looking at art are thinking, oh, I'd love to sit down, aren't they?
Yeah.
I wish these people weren't all here.
I can really understand why, if you were colossally wealthy, you would buy individual items of art, don't you think, and have them at home. And after supper, do we all just get a balloon glass of brandy and wander up and have a quick look at the old Modigliani up in our temperature-controlled loft?
Yeah, but that rather suggests you've got a house big enough to go for a wander in.
I'm talking about impossible wealth here.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, you'd have the big house as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So this chap, it must have cost him a pretty penny, Dermot Kennedy. It must have cost him a pretty penny to get in the Natural History Museum, you know, because presumably they have to get security men and to open it and so forth. You know, it can't be an easy thing to do. But I like the idea. You see, this is what's interesting.
The Natural History Museum are quite interested in promoting themselves.
I'm sure they are.
I mean,
no,
I can just remind people of what they've got.
Absolutely, that they're there.
And a whole load of people who've never been remotely interested in them via this guy will suddenly see all the extraordinary things.
But also, these, you know, attractions that are normally kind of overrun with people have a unique opportunity here to show it in a way that it's not normally seen, because there aren't tons of people going through there all the time. But and I think it's interesting because what it may be beginning to dawn on musicians, professional musicians, no matter how celebrated in this current moment, that music alone is no longer enough to get people, particularly to get people to put their hand in their pocket. you know, for something that they're not actually going to attend, that suggesting you're going to play a couple of tunes, people think, well, I can do that. I'll catch up with that
at
some point.
It's not sufficiently thrilling.
It's not sufficiently thrilling. And I just wanted to tie this in with Daniel Ek, who's the boss of Spotify.
Yeah.
Recently gave an interview where he was, you know, called upon to defend their ways of paying and so forth. I know we get the technicalities of that, but basically what appears to happen is that, you know, if you're Ed Sheeran or you're Taylor Swift or you're Beyonce, you make far more money than anybody's ever made in the past, because you don't have a manufacturing distribution limitation on the number of people you can reach. But if you're kind of in the middle, it doesn't appear to pay you as much as you might have got out of the old system of somebody giving you an advance to make a record.
And people aren't buying that music, they're renting it.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, well, they're not yet the streaming it. So,
yeah.
But he was saying that musicians have to get used to the fact that it's no longer acceptable to just do one something every few years and here's a product and expect to get the payback from it that they would have got in the past.
That's the old business model, isn't it? You used to go off and make a record, and then you tour that record, and then you take some time off and live off the royalties of the record.
Well,
exist anymore.
You see, I don't think I don't think it was as simple as that, because most of the time they would be living off the advance rather than the royalties.
Yeah.
So if you have a business, sorry, I'm going to sound like a LSA lecturer here, which I'm clearly not clever enough to be. But if you've got a business that's based on manufacture and distribution, yeah, here's a record. You can't do it yourself. Yeah. You can't go in there. You haven't got a studio of your own. You can't afford the musicians yourself. And you need a record company to actually manufacture all that, to make it fabulous, to put it into record shops, to advertise it, to try and drive people towards it. That's a betting business. And that works on the basis that Blue Thumb Records are prepared to give Ben Sidran, whatever it was, $50,000 every couple of years in the hope that they would get back more than the $50,000. And in most cases, they didn't get it back. In the overwhelming majority of cases, you talk to people who ran record companies, they said 95% of records don't make a profit. Small number make a huge profit. And so everybody down the line did quite well out of the fact that the record companies were prepared to just chuck money at them to make records in the hope that they would turn into that kind of thing. That's gone. So nobody's doing that anymore. Nobody's giving you advance to make your records. You put it out on Spotify, and if people find their way to it, happy days. If they don't, it's going to be hard work. And so what he's saying is the people who are working best on Spotify are the people who are doing stuff all the time. They're constantly active. They're finding ways of kind of animating their music, doing stuff around their music.
But that's just so true, because there's so many distractions, aren't there? Unless you're constantly reminding people. I thought it was really interesting that even people like Bruce Springsteen immediately during lockdown started doing performances, started doing radio shows, because he was just concerned about, you've got to just remind people that you're there.
But here's the question that I want to place before the massive. People might think about it. Did music, recorded music, was it formerly a manufacturing business, and is it now a service business? Yeah?
Right,
so manufacturing business is you make something.
Yep.
Hard for people to make themselves, and they then pay you for some kind of copy of it. A service business is you're there all the time. You're there providing some kind of version of yourself, yeah?
Yeah.
And it requires a very different kind of personality type than the manufacturing business fits into the kind of the idea of the the creative artist scribbling away in his garret or painting in his garret or whatever. And you know, has it shifted in the last 10 years? So it's now a service industry. I don't know the answer to that. But I think it's a fair question.
It's a fair question. When did musicians first start talking about themselves as creative artists? Because that's quite interesting. So you look at someone like the Beatles. The Beatles just thought of themselves as entertainers, didn't they? I mean, they made music and they were there to entertain you. I don't remember, apart from two occasions, that might have been after the Beatles split up. I remember John Lennon talking about Help and Strawberry Fields Forever, talking about how they were an element of self-expression in those. But otherwise, at no point did they say, this is me bearing my soul. It was just, here's something we've recorded. If you like it, great. And do you know what I mean?
I think that's absolutely right. And you know, if you look into the history of the most distinguished forms of art, Mozart or whatever, these people worked for money, didn't they? They worked to order. I need a mass for so-and-so's funeral, you know.
Yeah.
There is an opportunity for an opera here at the opening of an opera house paid for by a wealthy monarch or whatever. That's what they did. They didn't just say, here's a few tunes I've knocked out. See how you get on with them.
Yeah, exactly.
It didn't work like that at all, you know.
Or this is something about my life that I want you to connect with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think creative is the most overused adjective of our time.
But aren't there two different types of musicians? You think, you know, Mark King of Level 42 surely sees himself differently than Laura Marling, I would imagine. I don't know. Laura Marling, I suspect, is a creative artist saying, here is the latest episode about my life. And this is the music I've made. And if you like it, that's a bonus, but it's the music I want to put out. In a very kind of idealistic way, not that she isn't aware of the commercial success and otherwise of the stuff she puts out. Mark King is, let's go out and, you know, keep the old big red beach ball of happiness in the air, don't you think?
Possibly. But don't you think they all end up in the latter category? Because, you know, in your 50s, that's what you do.
You are.
You go out, you're a professional entertainer, you know. Whether you're the most serious jazz player or, you know, or a member of Bucks Fizz. You're a professional entertainer. You know, people pay to see you do your stuff. But creativity, people talk about it, sprinkle it around absolutely everywhere. And in context, it just doesn't seem relevant to me. Have you followed the story about Ellen DeGeneres?
No, what's that? Go on.
brings together two things. So Ellen DeGeneres, enormously successful host of big American chat show, personality show, obviously somewhat constrained in the current situation, but, you know, has been doing this for years, you know, kind of America's sweetheart. And you know, she has on a succession of equally beautiful, you know, Hollywood stars, people plugging records, books.
Yeah, no, I've seen it, whatever. Yeah.
And, you know, everybody's lovely, everybody's really sweet, and, you know. And so, but some story emerged about a month ago that behind the scenes on the Ellen show, it's not as nice as you might think, you know, that there might be some sinister kind of, you know, arm twisting and power politics and bullying going on behind the screens of a top showbiz sensation. Well, what a revelation did that turn out to be? We've never come across that before, have we?
We have. Arm twisting of who? Of the people on the show manipulate what they say?
Not the guests, but the people who work on it, you know, all that kind of thing. You know, it's pretty, in any TV situation where it appears to be sweetness and light, it is not sweetness and light. It cannot be sweetness and light.
It's a hard, mechanical setup that ensures that you get the program you want.
I'm not here to argue about the rights and wrongs. I've no clue about the rights and wrongs. It may be completely innocent. But what's amazing is that everybody appears to be kind of backing away from it so quickly. They're now talking about the show being taken off. You know what I mean? Just on the basis of what somebody said about what goes on. And the network and everybody, because everybody's so terrified of being near anything that's got even a breath of scandal about it, that they just scurry away to another room. And you would have thought somebody would say, hang on, all right, now there may be problems here, we'll sort out the problems. But this is a very popular program, Ellen's a very popular entertainer, and we're going to back this, you know. They're clearly not doing this. They're running away from it. And I was just reading an account in the newspaper.
How fantastically easy it is to scupper anybody you wanted to by just simply sowing the seeds of a rumour.
But that's what you know. Because you know nowadays that the broadcasting authorities or the media authorities, as soon as there's anything, will run
a mile.
Because they don't want anything to do with it at all.
Yeah.
That's the, you know, and that's cowardly. You know, I don't know what the rights and wrongs are, but, you know, you shouldn't have to throw away the baby with the bathwater, and you know, in that kind of fashion. But then I was just reading a thing in the paper where there's a quote from a friend of Ellen, which is probably, it might be made up by the journalist, I don't know, or a PR or something, and says, Ellen's really upset because she's always seen herself, she's very, very proud of the show, and she thinks she's a really creative person. And you think to yourself, Ellen. Now, Ellen DeGeneres. Okay, yeah, Mozart, Ellen DeGeneres, you know. I don't know. But Ellen DeGeneres is a very, very good, popular entertainer. She's got to have had a fantastic career for a long, long time and will no doubt continue to have one. Creative? Does Ellen DeGeneres sit there and go,
that's not creative.
Brilliant idea.
Being a chat show host is not creative, is it? It's you simply being extremely good in a particular discipline.
You can be good,
and it's a great art, my God, but it's not creative.
No.
You're not waking up in the morning with a blank sheet of paper and by the end of the day having produced something that was never there in the first place.
Exactly. You know, if you look at the great chat show hosts, you look at David Letterman, you look at Johnny Carson, you look at Terry Wogan, would they have for 1 minute have described themselves creative? I don't think so. They would have thought, I'm good at this, and boy, I'm lucky to have this.
You absolutely.
Because this is the format that describes my talent absolutely perfectly. I can do this thing, and 99% of other people cannot do this thing. I'm bloody good at it. Why is it just not enough to say, I'm good at this?
Yeah.
You have to say, I'm creative, you know. You know, I don't know. It's a different thing. Sorry,
I agree with you. I mean, I wonder when people got across the idea of calling musicians artists too. When did that first happen? You know, was that the press that called that? And is it the press that, because the press tend to talk to people about, you know, the inner workings of their soul and the things that inspire the songs they wrote, does that give them the impression that they are, I don't know, that they're more than just entertainers?
Now, I'll tell you what would be interesting to trace. If the libraries were open and you could go back and do this, and you know, here's a PhD idea for somebody who's doing the right kind of degree. When did the word in kind of popular entertainment, when did it stop being artiste with an E and turn into artist?
Artist, precisely.
Because I think if you looked in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it would have been artiste, you know, which was it.
Artist simply meant somebody appeared on stage, wasn't it?
Well, an artiste, you could be a variety artist, couldn't you? You could be, and I think it's very interesting. All these things that I'm very taken by the fact that the Beatles and Frank Sinatra would have regarded themselves as recording artists, rather than artists. Very different thing.
Yeah,
you know, and what they were saying was. Not that they probably didn't even say that openly, but if they had, they would have been saying, I'm really good at getting whatever is in me onto a record. That's what makes me exceptional, you know. And it doesn't mean I have greater, more profound thoughts than anybody else. It just means I'm an artist when it comes to recording. And I think that's the, you know, people talk about the Beatles as songwriters and all these things. I was thinking, no, it's records.
They're record makers.
And the record, they're recording artists. That's what they were artists. But anyway, you know, so, you know, a performing musician or somebody, a tap dancer or anybody like that would be called an artiste, wouldn't they?
They would.
A variety artiste.
Yeah.
And whereas when it becomes artist, it makes people think Van Gogh. It makes people think Garrett. It makes people think I've suffered for my art, and now
it's your turn.
All that kind of thing. So I think
the old cliche is it was always that idea that they have created the music they want to create, and if you like it, that's a bonus. But I think is monstrously untrue, because everybody's aware of what sells. Everybody, no matter who they are, they're all looking at the sales of those records and reacting to them. If something doesn't sell very well, you do something about it.
And I suppose also, if you make your record nowadays and you put it on Spotify. And you presumably, I don't know, do you have a little, you must have it as a kind of musician, you must have some kind of dashboard as when you put these things on online. So you must be able to see exactly how many people have accessed your stream or whatever it is since the day before. Now, traditionally, when your record came out, grazed the top 40, then dropped out, you know, you're able to comfort yourself in the face of its failure by saying, well, record company never got behind it. There was a strike, came out the same week as the Pink Floyd album, you know, all those kind of things.
Wasn't supported. Marketing let me down.
You can't do that. No. You get up every morning, you look at it, you go, oh, one person's had a look at it since yesterday.
Yeah. I better do something different.
It's a very difficult thing, you know.
The Word Podcast, one of the few things you really need in life.
We've got some new Patreons, Mark, haven't we?
We have. And please, everybody, please, hats off and hurl them vigorously into the air for David Hancock.
Very good. Good work, David.
Yes, for Stephen Darleywall.
Yes.
For Joe Fowles, for Andrew Buchanan, and David Proud. We're very grateful. Thank you very much for supporting us. Fantastic. And we ought to mention, actually, there's another podcast, Gold, out at the moment. Number 36 has been re-promoted. And it's really, really good. It's all about us talking about kind of ludicrous iPhone picture taking at gigs, things that drive us mad, actually, that other audience members do, and how global warming has fueled a boom in rock festivals, so it's not all dead penguins. The joy of vinyl, and why Oh What a Night by the Four Seasons is the best sounding record on the radio.
Okay.
And there's the Chrissie Hynde story, Chrissie Hynde and the foie gras.
Oh, well, if you want to be reminded of that epic of anecdotage, Mark Allen and his anecdotage.
That's good.
You need to sign up to be a Patreon supporter, because that's the way you avail yourself of access to all these riches. So do go and have a look at patreon.com/wordinyourear, and you'll find out more and more details of all the ways that you can get involved and get special access to events in the future. Lots more coming down the line. patreon.com/wordinyourear.
The Word Podcast. What's wrong with being sexy?
Okay, Mark, anniversaries.
Well, it's the anniversary of the Beatles at Shea Stadium, which was in August 55 years ago, in 1965, which is an amazing thing, isn't it? The Beatles at Shea Stadium. It never fails to amaze me how it's story. It's nearly all of it on YouTube. I was watching some of it the other night. It's fantastic. 56,000 people. On the bill, Brenda Holloway and the King Curtis Band, Cannibal and the Headhunters, Sounds Incorporated, and the Young Rascals. And also, you were mentioning, I think, Daniel Tashin of the
Daniel Tashin's dad, Barry Tashin, was in a group called The Remains from Boston, and they were on that tour, and they played Shea Stadium with the Beatles.
What an incredible thing.
Although the Beatles went, they played Shea Stadium again, didn't they?
They played 66.
They did it.
Maybe they were on the 66.
Yeah, maybe on the 66.
Yeah.
But even on 65, did they do two shows? They didn't, did they?
No, they did one show. And they played $160,000. I don't really know. That's a lot or a little. Equivalent of about $1.3 million now. Which, if you think about it, they only play for half an hour. And Dave, there's a lot to be said for that.
Oh, absolutely.
12 songs. What is that? There were 2 minutes.
These are the songs.
Three are not by the Beatles, in fact. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's the amazing thing. You know, people talk rather sniffily about covers bands nowadays, you know. But the Beatles, this is absolutely, you know, beyond the height of Beatlemania. They were the biggest thing in the world. These are the songs that they played at Shea Stadium. Twist and Shout, which of course is not by them. It's Isley Brothers, you know, Phil Medley, Burt Russell. She's a Woman, which was the B-side of I Feel Fine.
Yeah, B-side, yeah.
And and then they played
Not McCartney's Finest Hour as a lyricist.
No.
She's no peasant. Sorry.
I know that anyway. She's no peasant. Yeah. Then I Feel Fine. Then Dizzy Miss Lizzie, Larry
Not
Williams.
Not one of theirs, yeah.
Which had been playing since Hamburg, probably. Ticket to Ride. Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby. Come on down, Carl Perkins, for a few more royalties. You know,
yeah.
That's not one of those. Can't Buy Me Love, obviously, is. And then they play the only song that they played off their new album, which had just come out, which is Beatles for Sale. They play Babies in Black.
Which oh, no,
they
played. Weird choice. It's a very odd choice because that's a kind of slow dirge-like waltz, isn't it? I mean, it's a brilliant vocal performance and all that, but it's hardly going to set a baseball stadium on fire. But
then they played Act Naturally, which was also on... no, or is it? I can't remember.
I think it is, but it's not one of theirs.
One of theirs. It's an old country song. Hard Day's Night, Help, and then finish with I'm Down, which is, of course... A masterpiece.
Which is fantastic. I mean, that, anybody listening who hasn't seen it, go and have a look on YouTube. It is brilliant. And by then, they're just giddy. They're high with how successful it's been. They can't believe the absurdity of it. They're actually in hysterics. John and George are just making each other laugh throughout the entire thing. John plays an entire solo on his keyboard with his elbow.
Oh, he used to do that.
Yeah,
I remember that tour.
Fantastic.
Because on that tour, actually, this is where they wore those kind of Nehru jackets.
Nehru jackets,
right?
They had the little sheriff badges on, the Wells Fargo sheriff badges.
Oh, right, of course. Yeah. And because on that same tour, this is classic. Or it must be the same summer or something. They played, I think I'm right in saying, the ABC Night Out, which was an ITV program. And ITV used to broadcast variety shows from seaside towns up and down England. And I'm pretty sure they did the ABC Night Out from Blackpool on that same tour, where they played some of the same songs, and he did that same thing with his elbow, and they're wearing just the same suits. So, you know,
there's a great bit of film of them. Again, it's a little clip. You can see them backstage just before they go on. Amazing that they're still being filmed just before they go on. And they talk about how, you know, they get really nervous and it's all fine when they go on stage, and they get to the point where they just feel like going to sleep about half an hour beforehand, which I can understand. It's like that kind of terrible, intense nerves. But then McCartney says, actually, we get less nervous at shows like this because you know, it's smaller shows where people can actually hear what you're playing. You get where he said, but people can't hear. And that's the absurdity of it. Now that they can't see the Beatles, really. There are no big screens in those days. And they can't hear them because they're using the old PA system and little tiny amps and things like that. So the whole exercise is just a confirmation that the group you like kind of actually exists. Really.
And that you've been there with
them. And you were there with them, you know. There's so many interesting things about it. The other is Ed Sullivan's intro. Ed Sullivan says, he says, now, ladies and gentlemen, honoured by their country, decorated by their queen, and loved here in America. Here are the Beatles, which is pretty much exactly what he said in the Ed Sullivan Show, actually, wasn't it, in 1964? And I love that idea that, you know, that what they're approving of is the idea that these rock and roll rebels are actually responsible, upright members of society. They're not a threat to the fabric of our morals, you know. You know, it's a very unusual thing. And whereas also at the time, you know, the Rolling Stones had been singled out as being the bad boys, hadn't they? Rolling Stones, who had already had some success in America with the kind of, you know, they were the kind of working class oiks, which must have irritated the Beatles, who really were working class
The American misreading of English class via the British English is a whole subject in itself. It's extraordinary to... It's extraordinary to reflect. So what are we saying? That's more than how many years ago is this?
55 years ago.
55.
It's incredible. Yeah, invented the stadium circus. It
were. Yeah, absolutely.
They broke so many records, and that was another one.
Yeah.
But look, we ought to get in a mention for the great Alan Parker, don't you think?
Yes.
Very sad. I mean, you came to the Cure Awards once. I can remember introducing him to Roger Daltrey.
Did they?
Yeah.
And, what was he doing there? Did
I
he
can't remember. I've simply completely forgotten. No, he didn't win something. I think he was presenting something. I would have looked it up. I can't remember, but he was there.
Well, he directed The Wall, didn't he?
He did The Wall. He did Bugsy Malone. And he did Fame, which I think was incredibly influential. I may be completely wrong, but if you think about Fame, it came out in 1980, didn't it? And that whole world, that look of the kind of leotards and the knee socks and the big hair.
Yes.
You know, I look back at it now, you know, that was 1980. Now, you and I were on Smash Hits in 1981. You launched Just 17 in about 1983, I think. And actually, that world, you know, that world of people like Bananarama, there's a certain look that I think was very influenced by Fame. And there was a certain, you know, a certain world that was opened up for people like Madonna, particularly, who was really, really huge around 1981, 1982. Yeah. The idea that girl with dance act, pop dance act, was suddenly going to take off. That really fitted. And she, you know, that started a tradition that went right through, you know, through, you know, the Spice Girls to... Right up till now, don't you think those kind of routine girls, you know?
Well, it's TV talent shows, isn't it?
Yeah, they're all, Lady they're Gaga all, they're seems all to somehow
grounded in the idea of the Fame Academy and all that kind of
completely.
Place, and of course, now there are Fame Academies.
That was based on the High School of Performing Arts in New York, wasn't it? Yeah. That's right.
I've seen quite a number of Alan Parker films, and you know they're all admirable in their way, but I have such a special place in my heart for Bugsy Malone.
Oh yes, good.
I do think is genuinely a kind of, the more you look at it now, the more remarkable it seems. It was the first, you know, feature film he'd made. He was a commercials director, and he just had this idea for making a film which was kind of a spoof of kind of Warner Brothers gangster films of the 30s, and it was a musical.
Yeah,
and the parts were played by kids, and you know,
inspired by a chorus line. Was that right? I think it was.
No, not a chorus. No, it's inspired by. No, if you look at it, it's,
oh no, sorry, no, no, sorry, that's completely
it's Jimmy Cagney kind of gangster films and stuff like that. But you know, hard boiled dialogue, and you know, the shooters, the machine guns are replaced by splurge guns that fire kind of cream pies at people, and we'll go and look at it now. And you wouldn't even be allowed to think it nowadays. You couldn't make that film nowadays for all kinds of, you know, all kinds of reasons that make you reflect more on nowadays than the past. Because it's a perfectly innocent, wonderful, beautiful film that by any kind of logical analysis didn't ought to work at all. But it just does. And the two things that make it work. One is Alan Parker's fabulous duration. He's just belief in the idea, the kind of warmth of the thing. And the other thing is, God bless him, Paul Williams' soundtrack. The songs from Bugsy Malone, which were all written and mainly performed by the great Paul Williams. You know, Say You Want to Be a Boxer, you know, all those kind of tunes, you know. We could have been anything that we wanted to be, but we decided we're the best at being bad. All hilarious lyrics, wonderful tunes, absolutely brilliantly performed.
By kids, incredible performances by them.
It's a wonderful thing. So I think we're going to, you know, as a fond tribute to Alan Parker, and also a tip of the hat to the great Paul Williams. Let's play out with a bit of Bugsy Malone.